When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A 1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to another episode of Insights, where we talk with Kevin Kenney about his first solo album in more than a decade and his first vinyl release since the 1990s, Think About It. The album features REM co-founders Peter Buck and Bill Berry, as well as Brad Morgan of Drive-By Truckers, Laura Joemitz of Drivin' and Cryin' Midland, Sturgill Simpson, and more. Think About It has its roots in the introspective solitude of the pandemic, and also the passing of Kenney's old friend, the iconic, oddball, musical improvisational genius and lightning rod philosopher, Colonel Bruce Hampton. The conversation starts with Kevin growing up in Milwaukee, but ultimately moving to Atlanta, where he formed his popular band, Drivin' and Cryin'. He told the story of how the band members met in Atlanta and that there was great synergy from the start. We also spoke about his prolific songwriting, how he simultaneously works on projects with Drivin' and Cryin', as well as his solo projects, and the enjoyment he gets from working with other artists.
How are you doing? Good to see
good.
You.
Good. Yeah, great to see you. It's been a while.
Welcome
been a minute,
to my office. Can you see my office here? Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. It's on my board games. So,
Okay, what's your favorite board game? What do you like to play?
I like Scrabble. But, I don't know. I got a Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. I think that might be kind of fun. But I play one with my granddaughters called Snoopy's Doghouse, which is pretty good. You roll your dice till you get all the pieces of the doghouse. So
what about Candyland?
Candyland is pretty good. Candyland was ahead of its time.
Yeah, right.
I'm trying to come up with a design for a Drivin' and Cryin' board game. Is what I'm trying to think of all the excuses of why people didn't come to the shows and. You know, like, go back, why is nobody, no one's at the show? No one came to the show. It was opening of duck hunting season. Go back two spaces. Sound man shouldn't have eaten at McDonald's. Go back one space, you know. So, you know, just.
Oh, my God. That would be so hilarious.
I know. Trying to, for 38 years of traveling, I've got to come up with at least 100 different chants.
It'll be like a Chutes and Ladders things when it's like it takes you all the way back to the beginning, like you're starting
all
over
the way back. There was that record promotion said it was over the next mountain. He lied. Back to square one.
Yeah, back to square one. Exactly.
The thing is, you never get through. You can't finish it. Like, there's absolutely
right.
No way you can finish it. There's only like, and even when you do, you just says, you know, congratulations. You've just wasted your time.
Right. Well, like
you made a lot of people happy on the way. So,
like, I've never finished a game of Monopoly. It kind of just ends whenever you feel like ending it, and then someone has more real estate than everybody else, and that's kind of life, right?
Yeah, you know, when life gets rough, it's best to just quit. That's what I say.
Right.
That's what I taught my kids. So, are you in? Is that Memphis outside the window there?
Yeah, we're right in downtown Memphis. We're, in fact, I'm going to get to that in a little bit because of a quote that you put out there. I'm going to talk to you about that. But this is your first solo album in a decade. Think About It.
Yeah.
It's coming out December 9th, obviously, like just, what is that, tomorrow?
Comes out tomorrow. So that's when you can place your orders. But yeah, we didn't do any pre-release or pre-orders. We just kind of like, let's just put it out on that day and see, make sure we have the records. We have the records and we might have the CDs soon. So. We're hoping they're on their way.
Right on. Well, before we get to the album, though, I kind of wanted to set this up because I wanted to kind of go back, talk to you about how Kevin Kenney got involved in music and all the stuff that you've done and your previous solo projects. And then we're going to get to this one because it kind of all builds on a lot of what you've done, I think.
Yeah, I think this is like my 10th solo record, I think, isn't it? Something like that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it is. But what's really cool is you kept Drivin' and Cryin' going through the whole thing. And then you've had all these other really cool projects that kind of stand alone in themselves. And so I thought that was a really cool creative path that you've taken. Not everybody can do that. Some people just kind of quit doing one thing and do another, and then maybe they go back, but they don't keep maintaining on through the whole process, you know?
Right. Well, you know, the first Drive Me Crying record is the first Kevin Kinney solo record, my first solo record, McDougal Blues, is Tim and Dave, or Tim and Jeff and Buren. They're all on it. The band's all on it. So it's also Broken Hearts Auto Parts. That's got Mac and Dave and Tim on it. That's all Driving and Crying. But it's just kind of, it's different. I write the same amount of rock songs as I do solo songs. So I wind up with an imbalance. So even early on when we tried to like add the Driving and Crying, like we have so many rockers on us on a whatever heavier songs, we always wound up with three acoustic songs or one acoustic song or, you know, whatever. And so I kind of had an overload of acoustic stuff. So yeah, it was really part of the Peter Buck was our, he was going to produce Mystery Road, our third album, and he did the demos for it. And then we went a different direction with a producer, but then Island was like, I hope he could do like your solo record or something. So that's where McDougal Blues came from. We went back to John Keane.
Very cool.
Focused on that. Like, so that's kind of where it started. And then I just kind of kept it up because they really feed off each other. Like when I need to take a break from Drive and Cry, and I do the solo stuff, and then the solo stuff, there's a fly in here somehow. It's like 80 degrees in Atlanta. It's so crazy.
I know. I think I just got bitten by a mosquito. Is that possible?
Yeah.
It's December. What the hell, right?
Or 8th or whatever it is. So they kind of feed off each other, you know. I need to do both, you know. Mm-hmm. I know when I, of course, the grass is always greener, so I made a way to, I could just keep jumping over the fence over and over and over again. So I don't really have that, you know, I don't play with the band, or I don't play with the band songs or the acoustic stuff, or I don't do acoustic stuff with the band stuff. It's like, it's all just, you know, we'll do McDougal Blues and Drive a Crying or Broken Hearts. And well, I mean, there are no rules, so there's no rules. Like, if you're not going to have rules, then don't have rules. So we just kind of go with the flow and see what the vibe of the day is, you know.
Yeah, so, you grew up in Milwaukee, right?
I did. I grew up in Milwaukee, the northwest side, west of the tracks. I went to Marshall High School. And one of my best friends was Brian Ritchie from the Violent Femmes. So I will never be the most famous person from my high school.
That was like, yeah, my parents. My dad graduated with Elvis Presley in his class.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad was always like, really, we have to go to Graceland for our high school reunion every time?
Did he?
Yeah, he had the high school reunions out there.
That was awesome.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah.
That'd be a good article. I think that you should have wrote that article. What's it like?
Yeah, it was pretty, pretty crazy.
Wasn't it like 3 a.m?
in a furniture store. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's Elvis for you. So what was Milwaukee like? There was Summerfest, right? Like, you grew up and Summerfest was a thing, right?
It was a big part of my musical education because it was really, you could see Woody Herman and the Thundering Herd and Muddy Waters and Steve Miller. And you could see, you know, the Ramones. First place I saw the Ramones. First place I saw, like Johnny Cash. And you could get, you know, it was like, you know, it was a great, you know, oh, wait, I might have to sneeze. Sorry, I'm up in the attic here. So it was a really great education. It's a 2-week festival. You could go every day, especially in the summer. And my best friend, somehow his dad worked for Miller, so we always got free tickets. So it was just really great to be able to just, you could see, a Russian folk singer, or they had international stages, and they had blues stages and jazz, and You know, I see like the Brecker Brothers or, you know, I don't know if Chick Corea might have been too big for that stage. He probably played the big stage, but you know, just seeing whole Leon Russell, the band. I saw the band play there on their last tour. It was just a really great way to, you know, to see, to get a good rounded out musical education.
Did you ever play there?
I did. We drove a car, played there in their heyday. Yeah, we did one during Fly Me Crazy. I think we did a show there. Yeah. But I'm not really, nobody knows who I am in Milwaukee. Like I left, like I still play to like, you know, 80 people at the most, you know, we're not really a Midwestern band, you know, it never really translated. It was good that I got out of there because I think it would still be.
I think you're a Southerner. We've adopted you, Kevin. I'm just
saying.
Thank
you. Yeah, I think I am a Southerner. You know, my grandfather was from, you know, they're all from in Missouri, Southern Illinois. So we always have a little bit of that. My great grandfather, I think, or my great grand uncle. One of them was a tent revival preacher, something like that, in Missouri and Kansas and all that stuff, you know. So I think I have a little bit of that in my DNA, you know, my wanderlust and my, and you know, it's probably why I love Bono so much.
You know, I can't tell you how many guys I talk to who are musicians that came from a revival background, like the tent revival background. There's something kind of crazy and musical about it. And, you know, you can just do whatever you want to do. And it's just totally acceptable. And out of that, they're just crazy rockers. You know, it just comes out of that.
Yeah. You're just traveling on the road. It's kind of like what we do now, you know, just traveling in this caravan and you hope someone comes to your little shindig and your revival and you hope people get it. And, you know, so it's, you know, there's a little bit of that in there. I could see, especially when, you know, the early Sun, the Prisoners and all that early Sun stuff was, you know, all about that, you know. So
you grew up in Milwaukee. You learned to play guitar somewhere along the way when you were young, right? High school,
yeah,
or elementary school?
I was like 16. I was late learning guitar. I guess Brian Ritchie was, he played guitar. I used to remember going to the music store with him. He could play bar chords, you know, which was like, I was like, wow, you know, he could be like, you know, like what is that? Instead of it, I've got my guitar and I'm like playing the C, like C, G. And he's like, I was like, oh, wow, that's a lot easier than like.
I'm learning guitar, Kevin. I'm a fiddle player, but I'm learning guitar, and I'm sort of where you were back then. So I'm trying to like learn all these bar chords, and so some of the songs that I've written, they're really simple. And someone said, "Can't you put in some more chords?" I'm like, "Well, no, I can't, not yet."
Yeah, that's That's why I keep it simple.
Yeah. So
I started off. I what I really wanted to be was a writer. So I took journalism classes and I went to college for printing press. I wanted to make my own underground newspaper and things like that. I really wanted to write. And in doing so, I met this band called the Haskells in 1977, 78. And I became their roadie I was still in high school, but I would like go to Chicago or, you know, they didn't tour, but they played Milwaukee on the weekends. And I learned how to set up gear and watch a band practice. And I mean, they were my rock and roll high school. Like I learned everything about rock and roll, how to make a poster, how to promote a show, how to do like three sets a night, how to rehearse, you know, how many rehearsals it takes to learn a new song. And all this, it was really a great education. I got fast tracked from this, you know, into this thing. And then just by default, learning how to tune guitars and stuff, I learned how to play it a lot better, you know? So it and then I started a punk rock band with the other roadie, and we had a band called the Prosecutors. And so it was me and him were a little punk rock band for a while. And,
Now, were you still in Milwaukee then, or had you moved?
This is all still Milwaukee.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I actually had a career. Like, I had a whole, I did a whole bunch of jobs. I was a pharmacy tech and all these different jobs. I worked for record stores. I worked for Peaches. I worked for this place
called Records. I love Peaches.
I was a 45 buyer at Peaches on Silver Spring Road in Milwaukee. The sound man of the band was the manager, so he kind of got me in. And then I worked with records for a pretty long time. I worked for One Stop in downtown Milwaukee. They had one copy of every record. There was like the Library of Congress. If it was in print, they had one copy of it, because we would sell 700 copies to, make an order up. And sometimes it'd be like four copies going to a barber shop in Southern Illinois. You know, it was really great. Like, really learned a lot about classical. I learned all about the labels. I learned, and I just got turned on to, tons of music and just lots of different fans. And I love 45s and stuff like that. So I kind of, I've just been obsessed with music, my whole performing and music, and the magazine that I started is still in Milwaukee. It's called the Shepherd Express now. And it's kind of, like the creative loafing of Atlanta or something like that, And
what would you say that you were able to sort of combine, your desire to write, I guess, with music, because that's what music writing is. And it's all about lyrics and song, but you already had a career in writing that kind of helped.
Well, I was not a very good writer. I lacked the attention to write. I could never write a book, anything like that. I could write an article, but I always wound up being kind of like prose, it was never coherent. I might have been on some sort of spectrum back if I would have been tested, but I found songwriting the perfect thing, because I could write the outline of the story. I could put a few teaser lines in there from the characters and create a soundtrack all within 5 minutes. And like Good Country Mile is this beautiful, the song is a really great story arc. And I could put it all in 7 minutes and it's done, and it has emotion to it. It's good for people with short attention spans. They get a whole movie within 7 minutes. And so I thought this is a really great way to express yourself, And so, I really ran with it. And I've never stopped writing, having multiple songs in the works at all times, because I never know when I'm going to lose the gift, So I'm kind of always putting records out. Just, sometimes they're not, I made a couple like Down Outlaw, the one I made in Memphis that is, I think it's out of print now, but that was kind of fast. I made a couple that have maybe rushed a little bit, but they're documented. This one coming around again, I didn't have a voice, but there's always room to redo or whatever. I don't mind redoing my songs if I have to, as I've done on this new record. I did redid three songs on there that have already been written, but I did, I approached them as a 60-year-old instead of a 16-year-old, it's a little bit different, but yeah.
So why did you move to Atlanta then originally from Milwaukee? What prompted you? Did you know someone down there or?
Yeah, my brother walked the Appalachian Trail, and he wound up in Atlanta, and he was here making a pretty good living, working, at the water plant. And then, He was in a bluegrass band. He's in the Georgia Music Hall of Fame for old time fiddle. He's an old time fiddle player.
Oh, nice.
His name is Mickle Kinney, M-I-K-E-L, and Kinney. And yeah, he's an old time fiddler, So he's got all of his friends are like 100, Yeah. And so he teaches old time fiddle and things like that. And, he's got a variety of projects he works on and does. I think he's got a YouTube. I think he teaches over Zoom and things like that. But so yeah, he was like, "You should come down here, man. They got construction jobs here." And so I was like, "Okay." So I moved down because, you know, me and my girlfriend at the time, I had a Honda Civic. We stopped, and our very first stop was Graceland. We went to Graceland when Elvis's
aunt. Of course.
That was 80. That was 82. So it was only 5 years after he died. So it was like his aunt was still living there and the cars were still in the driveway in the back. And he couldn't go in the kitchen or the jungle room because his aunt was living there. And they still had the slot car track set up where they have all the records now. It was really good. He couldn't go into the racquetball court. And the plaza across the street where the museums are now was still had the hamburger joint, you know, remember that?
Oh yeah.
That little strip mall was still there. So it was cool. And then we went and stayed in Arkabutla, Mississippi for 2 weeks. Well, maybe 10 days, but a little over a week. We stayed at Arkabutla, Mississippi at the Arkabutla Dam and camped there and then came to Atlanta and ran out of money. And wound up building sewage plants after that.
So how did you guys meet then in Driving and Crying? Like, when did that happen? And how did that happen?
Well, I made a demo tape with a guy I met in Smyrna, Georgia, where I lived. And he was a friend of mine. He was I think he was a Wicca priest. and I made a demo with him. He had a futon shop. So I worked for him for a little while too, but yeah, we made a demo tape called Everything Looks Better in the Dark. And, I think you can get it on eBay. It's got a great cover. I didn't put it out, but, we were just handing it out. I was handing it out to people, you know, and then I ran into Tim Nielsen from Driving and Crying, you know, he was in the Night Porters and he was like, man, you need to, you know, we need to find you a band. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do that again. I already did that.
I mean, were you writing music already or?
What's that?
Were you writing music at this point?
I never stopped. Yeah, I'd started. Okay. The prosecutors had a song called Driving and Crying, my punk rock band.
Ah, okay.
This is where the song, where the title of the band came from. And we released, you can get that on iTunes too or whatever it is. You can find it. So I just could, I've never stopped writing ever since I started, you know. I've always been exploring different ways of communicating, you know, but, you know, it wasn't until, you know, later, probably in the Driving and Crying era where I was like, not afraid to look in the audience and like share and really kind of try to come up with something that was a little more, made a little more sense, you know. I wasn't afraid to make a little more sense, you know, or just like Scarred But Smarter. I got a little, which was kind of a heavy song, you know, but it's like a preachy song. But it wasn't until the 80s till I really started writing, late middle 80s, till I started writing more things that were a little more relevant to, you know, common regular people, you know.
Well, so in the late 80s, let's talk about the 80s. In the early 90s, you released Mystery Road and Fly Me Courageous. Both of those were big albums. They had hits like Straight to Hell, Honeysuckle Blue. What was life like when you go from working in the futon store to being a full-time musician and touring? And it had to be fun, I would think.
Yes, I think when I made our first record, in 87, or the first Island record, 87. I remember having to ask off for work. So I think I was still working when I was on Island. I was working at a cabinet shop, driving a truck. You know, Driving and Crying has always been a very cult kind of band. You know, it's pretty close. We are still kind of in the same, where we could tour in the kudzu circuit in the South, you know, Atlanta, Memphis, New Orleans, Charleston, Nashville. But outside of that region, we're just like a really underground kind of like play to 80 people kind of band, maybe 100 people. So it's, you know, it, We've never had to like have a reality check. We've never needed a humility check. You know, all we have to do is book a gig in Ohio, know where you really stand. You know, it's like, you know, if you think your bridges, go play Milwaukee. You know, it's like Chicago. You know, so we were never really that big outside of, except for that one summer for Fly Me Courageous, and we were opening for people, and you know. Was not my favorite era, you know. My favorite era really has been like the last 15 years. It's been really great, you know, where I'm not in competition. I'm not trying to prove myself. I am who I am. I'm doing what I do, take it or leave it. You know, the pressure of it being cut out isn't really a reality anymore. There's no such thing as being cut out anymore. You know, in right. The old days, like Whisper Tim's Lion was cut out, and I was like, oh no. No one's ever going to hear this. Who's going to find this record, you know? And so when they created iTunes and Spotify and all that stuff, and I know that, you know, people who sold millions of records really felt the pinch, but for bands that sold thousands of records, it was freaking awesome because it was available to people in Spain and the Netherlands and Japan and Mexico, you know, Denmark and Seattle and places that we just can't go to. So there's no excuse to not listen to it, you know, and it's always out there. It'll be out there for the next 50 years. And that's exciting to me that some kid and, you know, when I'm dead, will find us and be like, that was pretty good, man. You know, I kind of dig that, you know.
So well, it's amazing. Yeah, well, and it's amazing what the internet did for independent artists, because there was such a machine before that, and then all of a sudden, hey, you know, I can put it out there myself if I want to, and I don't need anybody else. Granted, you know, labels have distribution and they have all the other things that go along with that, but there are countless examples of artists that just put it out there and they find their fans, and it's great. Well,
yeah, we were lucky enough to have Island give us four or five albums, and then, you know, that was it. And then we had Geffen give us that one record. And I appreciated the times that we did have an album, a label, because, you know, they take all the details that we have to do now. I mean, we've made our, Driving Crying and me have made our own records. I think The Flower and the Knife was the only one, maybe, I think, that was the one I did with Warren Haynes. I think that was I think his label paid for that one. Evil Teen.
How did you meet Warren Haynes? Was just
I met him through Edwin McCain and Hootie at a benefit show in Charleston. Well, I actually knew him. I had actually that I said true. That's when I first started playing with him. But the first time I met him was his wife Stephanie Scamardo worked as one of our A&R people in the A&R department in Island Records in New York. So that was her boyfriend at the time. I said, oh, and he was like, yeah, my brother, but my husband plays in the Allman Brothers. I was like, no way. So
that was another one of your projects. So what was that particular project like, and what was it like working with Warren?
It was great. I went to Hoboken to this Water Studios, it's called, and I remember I got it. They had a apartment above the studio, and Warren came in and brought a tape player, put a little cassette player, and I sang him like 20 songs. He picked the top 10 and said, "Okay, these are the ones." He went home and listened to them. He goes, okay, these are the ones I think we should work on. And he brought Jerry Garcia's guitar, and that's what I was playing. And he brought in, and he played, me and him just kind of went back and forth and played some music together. And he was like, that's a good take. That was good. And then he had some friends in town, they're called Frog Wings. It was Butch Trucks and Jimmy Herring and O'Teal and Derek Trucks and John Popper and Edwin McCain. And they were all kind of like doing this thing at Wetlands. They did for a whole week. And then they had different celebrities like Hanson or whatever, Spin Doctors or whatever, you know, would come in. And so they, when their sessions were over or before their sessions, they would come over to Hoboken and put down some tracks. So there's a really great song on there called Kerouac, which has Derek Trucks, Jimmy Herring, O'Teal, Burbridge, and Warren Haynes. And it is the weirdest. It is like, when you think about it, it sounds like a jam band heaven. You'll have to listen to Kerouac someday. It's kind of cool. It's a really weird.
Yeah, no, you know, that's I'm going to look it up right after this because I now want to hear it.
You got to hear Derek. You can hear Derek. Like, he's just, it's such a great song. It's the most awesome non-jam band song ever. It's so great. And so Jimmy Herring's just like, playing all these crazy Colonel Bruce craziness in there. It's really awesome.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Colonel Bruce in a sec, but what was the project with the Golden Palominos? Tell me about that one.
Well, Anton lived in New York, and when I moved to New York in 2005 or something like that, or I'm not sure when I moved there, but Aaron Lee Tashin was living with me at the time, and he said, you know, I went down to this bar, and a guy, Anton Fierce, says to say hello to you. He's like, I said, what? Anton's playing in town? He goes, yeah, he plays every Tuesdays at Marion's down in the basement of this Marion's, him and Tony Shear and another guy. They play a little trio down there. And so I started going to visit, went and see him play. And I was like, this is so great. I haven't seen you in a long time. And then we started practicing like every Tuesday and Thursday, you know, in New York. We play every, you know, so every so often on Monday nights or some, you know, we didn't play that much. We did the pianos, the living room, and the National Underground, which was owned by Gavin DeGraw and Joey DeGraw. And we played with Aaron. Aaron was in the, so it was this revolving thing where, you know, the Palominos is Anton and then whatever kind of musicians he's working around. So it wound up being, me, Anton paid for this record. He paid for all the recording out of it. And it was called Good Country Mile. And it was Anton put the whole thing together. It was Anton Fear. It was Andy Hess on some of it. I don't know if Catherine Popper's on it or not. I can't remember. Tony Shear, Eleanor, Chris and Eleanor, the Dukes and Duchess, you know, Eleanor Whitmore and Chris, Aaron Lee Tashin, Keith Christopher, maybe, I'm not sure, but it was a really great project that Anton put together. It was Kevin Kinney and the Golden Palominos. So it was put together through all my practices that me and Anton would just, I didn't have anything to do. So I just go down there. Me and him sit down there and play for 2 hours, 3 hours and, you know, just smoke pot and play music. Just like we're 16. It was great. A lot of good memories of doing that. Yeah.
Are you going to invite me next time?
Yes, absolutely.
I want an invitation.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Think About It. That's the latest album, and it's a segue from talking about Colonel Bruce Hampton, because this album is a little bit about or inspired by him. Tell me about him and what inspired you about him.
Well, he was a close friend of mine for many. Like he was, I remember him being in the room when we first met our very first lawyer in 1985. It was this guy Charlie Phillips was our lawyer. And his brother was Glenn Phillips, and Glenn Phillips played with Colonel Bruce in his band called the Hampton Grease Band. And I remember Colonel being over there in the corner, and like Jim, I think he was in tennis shorts. I think they just got done playing tennis, and it was one of these things where I sang a couple songs for them, you know, hey man, play me some songs. So, that's when I met him. But then just over the years, he became like a really close friend of mine. We would do the Christmas jams together, of course, and he just, you know, would come see me, and we never played together. But we got together weekly or every couple of weeks, and would hold court, or we'd go have our favorite Vietnamese restaurant, or he would pick a restaurant, and he would just be like, Papa Deo's 706. Okay, I'll beat you. So, yeah. So, you know, he was there. I was on stage with him when he died, and that was really, really beautiful way for him to go. It was really, really a beautiful, you know, I couldn't have been more fitting. We had a great last supper together. We had Indian food in the basement, you know, surrounded by John Bell and Warren and Jimmy and Derek. And it was really a great moment, I remember. And then he died like 3 hours later. But I am, when I was putting this, I've been putting this record together for years now, probably 4 or 5 years, where I wanted to do a record that was not me just like doing my Kevin thing, you know, like kids, no band, you know, as I say, I got that this voice that I had to invent so I could hear myself over the monitors in the 80s. And so I wanted to do something like I really talk, like I really, the way that I would sing to you if I was in your apartment at like 3 mm-hmm. in the morning and you had neighbors and it's like, you know, I want to play you a new song. It's like, I'm not going to be like full on, you know, like, you know, stop, look, listen, think, you know, it's like, stop, look, listen, think about it. This world. So I'm singing very quiet and very like, I don't have any background. It's kind of a personal conversation between me and the listener. And it's like a late night kind of thing. And it's, it's kind of just kind of an intimate kind of, you know, record. But it started off with, I said, I saw Colonel with the Kevin Scott and Darren Stanley. They used to play with the Colonel. I thought, oh, I'd like to do a whole record like that, you know, with like the stand-up bass and the drum and the jazz thing. So we did half of it, and then they took a break in January, and we're going to come back in March, and then the world shut down. So the first side one is that representation of the way the record was going. And side two kind of became some of the songs that I didn't have finished. And so I had a David Barbie play bass and Brad Morgan as my rhythm section for those ones. And then the final song was the Stop, Look, Listen, Think. Is kind of like the end of the movie, kind of like the end of, it's like stop, look, listen, like where everybody comes out, like stop, look, you know, like in my mind, it's like a Broadway show. It's like, that's like the big band record, like
big finish.
Bill Berry plays drums and he plays all these different rhythm, like he's playing maracas and tambourine, and he just really made this great percussion thing out of it. So and then after that final, then the final credits, there's like I do an acapella song at the end that I wrote about the Mississippi River. So yeah.
Well, you know, the people that you kind of put together on this album, the collaborators all come from different genres. Was that intentional, or was there a purpose in putting these guys together specifically?
No, I don't have any, you know, everybody's the same age and same for me. It's, I don't really like Lauer Jo Metz is like in his early 30s, but he's just an old soul. And, I was planning on having him come to Athens to do it, but it was shut down. So we sent him the tracks and he did his stuff in the studio in Nashville. But Peter Buck was there when we first recorded it. He happened to be in town doing this benefit show in Athens. So he came by for 2 days and brought all of his old regular REM guitars. And it was really great. So he plays on half the record. And I wanted him to do more, but I couldn't. He usually records remotely with Scott McCoy, and Scott wasn't really seeing people, you know, because he had a, you know, he's being really cautious about the you know, lockdown thing.
Did that make it challenging then to put this together? Because it was you're putting together some of this during lockdown. Was that hard?
Really, because we had so much time, you know, you know, I don't rush anymore to do anything. you know, I'm not in any hurry. No one's, you know, no one's lining up to know, you know what I mean? It's, there's no deadline. So, it was, just, you know, it's like I tell people, just listen to the song will tell you what it wants. And it's, and that's really good. And I knew I wanted strings. So we had this really great girl come in and do some string charts for a couple of the songs. And that was really great. And I knew what we did. We wanted to keep it very clean and sparse. So we really kind of were like, I think five instruments per song would be the max. So we usually have bass and drums and maybe like a vibraphone and a guitar and then me. And so it's like, we try to keep it at like five instruments or less per song. You know, we didn't want to, it wasn't like a, it was the anti Phil Spector kind of thing. Very, we kind of keep it very clean and very, cause the stand up bass is such a beautiful sound to it. We really didn't want to get in the way of it, you know?
So, when you recorded it, you said in Athens, what is it you love about Athens?
Well, it was, you know, a place I ran away to, you know, in the '90s when I was just, it's just like a, it's like Mayberry, except Nirvana plays there. You know, it's just kind of a small town.
Well, all these crazy bands have come out of there. I'm fascinated by that. You know,
yeah.
It's just, and I've been there and it's such a cool place, but you just don't think that that's what would come out of there, but it does. It's nuts.
Well, you know, the college has a lot of disgruntled, wanderlusty, students who like come, to, you know, they learn and then they find the music scene and then they, you know, they are in dire need to express their frustrations, and what better way to vent your frustrations publicly than to start a band and just like, and then something happens, you know, you start with just like the B-52s, like one string, like, you know, and then you just go from there and you just, it's become this, you know, pylon. And they were really on the, you know, they really had the art scene dialed in there. You know, they were just very open-minded. The students were, I think were back, but it was back when, you know, when kids could drink at 18. So it was, there was a lot more people in the bars, but I don't know, you know, I think the frat scene there, I think we made a lot of money. Like in the old days, it was the only people that would pay you $1,000 would be like a frat, you know. You have to suffer through three sets and drink and beer and singing the song they like 12 times. If you know, they're kind of assholes and we hated them, but they did pay a lot of bills, you know. So it worked out well, you know, until we got sick of them. But
well, you probably created some lifelong fans too. I mean, those guys probably love you. So
yes, they did. We played a lot of. There was a couple really good ones. Like I think at ASO or ATU, one of them was like a really cool art. Like they had ones all over them. We all kind of did. I think it was at ATO. I can't remember, but yeah. I mean, to this day, I'm playing a lot of 50-year-old birthday parties for people like I saw you. You know. I'm happy to do it. But yeah, they were like the first music fans, you know, that was, you know, would pay you money. And so that's why Athens had such a great music scene, because they could really, they needed more and more bands to do these parties and play the 40 watt and things like that. So it was a real supportive music scene, I think. You know, by the time I got there, I was more running away. I wasn't trying to be part of the music scene. I was kind of hiding, you know, it's just because I really just loved the small, I love being able to walk downtown and eat good food and, you know, and, you know, I was never really, I moved there. I probably lived there for 12 years or more. And I was never really considered a citizen. Like it's a weird dynamic. I was always Kevin Kinney from Atlanta. I was never, I made three albums there. I was never, you know, I was never a townie, you know, which was what they call them. You know, I was never really indoctrinated into the.
Well, they're probably used to having all those students and that mentality of, hey, people come and go, you know, they're not from here necessarily. Right. And they're going to leave.
Yeah. But yeah, it has a good vibe to it. It sounds like, you know, everything you do there kind of sounds like Athens, you know. It's a very nonchalant kind of, you know, it's you know, not a lot of pressure, you know, but they may have the elf power and the elephant six stuff they do and all the Vic Chestnut, the Vic checks. And I lived, you know, I had Michael Stipe was 2 blocks away and Mike Mills was 3 blocks away and Vic Chestnut was 3 blocks away. And it's fun to run into those, you know, last time I ran into Kurt Cobain was talking like outside the coffee shop. I mean, he was staying with Michael and he was holding his daughter and we were talking about Peter and the Wolf and talking about the bassoon and, you know, it's just a small town. So it's, you can get a, it's a really, I take advantage of it, you know?
So the new album is coming out on vinyl. I love the resurgence of vinyl. So, and you have great album art. It's a very cool album.
Thank you.
So was it hard to get it produced on vinyl? I mean, that's not the easiest thing these days. It takes forever, I hear.
Yeah, it's great that they're making vinyl and it was, but you know, I think that, unfortunately, the resurgence of vinyl made it, you can't just open up a record pressing plant. It takes a lot of just technicians and it's a very complicated procedure.
Have you ever toured one? Have you ever been inside one?
Yes. Yeah,
yeah, they're very cool.
The one in Athens is really great. It's called, what's the one in Athens called? I can't remember. I forgot their name. But
we have one here in Memphis called Memphis Record Pressing.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, very cool plant. And they've grown, doubled and tripled, and it's been crazy. Yeah.
Well, what happened was that people started collecting the album covers. Like, and I don't know how good their stereos are, but you have to have a good stereo to make vinyl work. You know, you can't play it on a $99 Amazon Crosley. It's, you're not going to enjoy it. It'd be better if you got the CD or listen to it, you know.
So that is a very good point. That part hasn't caught up yet at all, because when we were growing up, they had amazing turntables, right, and systems. Right. And now that's what you have. You know, most people go in and buy these inexpensive turntables and, you know, it seems like the equipment hasn't caught up yet.
Even the ones that look like good turntables are kind of crappy. You have to really spend $500 at least to get a good turntable that's really, you can really appreciate the vinyl. So that brings me to the, like, trying to keep, you know, when these record pressing plants, they're small, you know, there's not huge ones left anymore. I mean, the Memphis one's probably one of the bigger ones. But they get clogged up with Adele and Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran and Paul McCartney and the Stones and Zeppelin and all these reissues that they're selling at the Urban Outfitters. And people are buying them because they look cool. And then they're playing them on their Crosley record player or whatever. I don't know what. So, you know, I'm glad they're buying them, but it's ruining it for a lot of us independent people who like have been trying to keep it alive. And now we're like in the back of the line. Like we got to wait 8 months now to get a vinyl pressed. So, you know, I think I'm going back to CDs.
Maybe
go back to CDs until they build more pressing plants.
I was going to say, maybe you can just buy your own record press. You know, just DIY. Know,
Peter Buck told me he had an opportunity to buy one in Seattle. There was like a bunch of people found like 8 presses. But he said the people that the engineers that made those records, they're very hard to find them. It's hard to find those people because
they are. Yeah.
They were trained in a certain, they were experts at it and they made millions of records. And then when they retired, they really didn't pass it on to anybody and there's really nobody teaching it, you know? So unfortunately, I think they're bringing up more and more, like more people are coming are learning how to do it, and people are finding out that there's profit. So maybe Bill Gates will get involved and buy a huge pressing plant, or maybe Elon Musk will buy one. But unless people listen to it correctly, it's not, they're going to be like, it doesn't sound that much better. It's like, yeah, because you're playing it on a piece of crap.
Crummy piece, right? Crummy machine.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have one last question for you about the album, though. I read that you call the album a Jim Jarmusch black and white soundtrack. And I love that reference just because I love Jim Jarmusch. And
yeah,
we're a block from where he filmed Mystery Train. That's where our studio is.
Yeah.
And
by the Lorraine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's exactly where we are. We back up right to the Lorraine Motel. And I just wanted to hear from you what that reference was about and from, you know, why you made that reference in particular.
Well, it's I got the Criterion app for my, I like to watch the Criterion Channel. You know, it's $100 a year, but you get full access to all black and white Criterion. I just love that black and white, you know, cigarettes, you know, what was it with smoking, what was that called? Smoking cigarettes, or I don't know, but you know, just it's that Jim, that really dark kind of like, if I did videos for that, they would all be in black and white and all have a lot of shadows. And, you know, it would be a very black and white. It's a very black and white record, you know, I think. So when I close my eyes and I see it, that's kind of what I see. Except at the end with the Stop, Look, Listen, Think song, I think that might be like a transition to some color, you know, a little bit of color in that one.
But are we all going to heaven after that?
Sure. Or Stuckey's.
Right, or Stuckey's.
Yeah.
Okay, I actually did a Stuckey's tour of the South one time where anytime I passed one, I had to stop there.
There you go.
A lot of them, you know. There's a lot of them.
Again, the girl, Stephanie Stuckey, is an acquaintance of ours. So we have some Stuckey's paraphernalia here. And I think they're bringing Stuckey's back. I think there's plans to – I think they're still out there, but I think they're planning on revamping them a little bit.
Hey, there's a place for Stuckey's. I love Stuckey's.
She brought us a 6-pack of Stuckey's pecan roll beer. So
wow.
It was pretty good.
I didn't know they had beer.
Huh?
I didn't know they had beer at Stuckey's.
Well, it was a prototype that they gave me a 6-pack of. So I wish I kept a can, but so I don't know what I did with them, but they were pretty good though. Very mapley pecan beer. Yeah, they do beer. This million.
Okay, beer. Well, you know, we're going to meet up at a Stuckey's one day. How about that?
There you go.
Listen, Kevin, it was so great talking to you.
I'm looking forward to coming and doing another Diddy TV. I think I've done two of them, or have I done two or three?
Yeah.
I've been in that building at least two or three times, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, come on.
It's
come
really
over
one
and visit
of my. It's always one of my favorite things to do. It's such a cool little vibe down there. You know, it's really awesome.
All right, folks, we hope you enjoyed this conversation with Kevin Kinney about his first solo album in 10 years and his first vinyl release since the 1990s. Think about it. Kevin always inspires us with his creative drive and his prolific ability to produce amazing solo projects while still making new albums with his driving and crying bandmates. He also tells us the real story about the life of a working musician. Thanks again to Kevin for joining us on Insights. We appreciate his sense of humor, and we hope everyone will get to see him perform next time he's in your neck of the woods. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again soon, right here on Insights.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.